We have all been through it. Most of you listening are probably still in it right now. It's this really turbulent time in our development when emotions are at an all-time high, right? It's when our need for acceptance and for belonging pushes so much of our behavior because we're trying to connect with peers, we're being intimate for the first time. We rebel against the system, we rebel against our parents, we do dumb things, we take risks. It's a time in our life when we are probably the healthiest that we will ever be, but at the same time at an intense risk for serious injury and even death, right? Most people think that adolescence is a human thing. Some people even say it's like a cultural construction. But the truth is, adolescence exists all across the animal kingdom. You know, and you hear all the time people say, you know, the youth of today, they're so lazy, they're out of control, they're rebellious. But if you go back and you look at quotes all the way back to Socrates over 2,000 years ago, they were saying the exact same thing about the youth of their day. And when you look across these different species, you see very similar behaviors popping up all across the animal kingdom during this period of life. And so it points to something that's universal, right? There's something happening to our bodies and to our brains during this developmental process that's pushing our behavior into this kind of predictable pattern. And so what we really want to get into today is, what is the purpose of these really common behaviors that are kind of peculiar to adolescence? And what we really want to do is kind of paint this perspective that adolescence isn't just this time that we need to survive, right? Hold our breath and hope that we make it through. It's a time for thriving, for growth, for flourishing. And if we can really kind of change that perspective, we can maybe stop pathologizing adolescence and move instead towards providing the youth of today with the opportunities that they need to have the chance to know who they are, to build skills and strategies that will turn them into successful adults in our society.
Welcome to The Social Brain. I'm Andrew.
And I'm Taylor. And this is a show where we dive into how the brain works. If you've ever wondered what's going on inside your mind, even the things that you're not even aware of, then this is the place where we can unpack that and really explore it.
Yes, yeah, and it's actually, it can seem kind of mundane to think about this period of life, but I think it's really a fascinating, as you were just outlining, really fascinating thing that's common to so many mammals and animals in the animal kingdom, but especially with humans, it's this really interesting period of life. I think if I were to put one word to it, it would be exploration. But I think we should probably, as we like to do, define like what we're talking about, right? Because adolescence is one of these terms that is thrown around like all, you know, in our common use of language. It's also like a scientific term. People have different definitions for it. So like, maybe we'll clear up some confusion by talking about the difference between adolescence and teenagers and puberty. Maybe that's a good place to start.
That is a good place. Cause I mean, I think there's this misconception that like adolescence is like the teenage years, or adolescence and puberty are the same thing, right? Puberty is very different. Puberty is usually the start of adolescence across species. It's usually like, okay, puberty has started. So there's changes that are happening to the body. There's major changes that we'll talk about kind of throughout the episode happening to the brain as the brain kind of gets restructured. But puberty itself is pretty short-lived compared to adolescence. And it's really interesting too, because the time that puberty starts has actually changed a lot over the last like 50, 60 years. And I think it was like 1950s, 1970s, average age of puberty for girls was 14 and a half, and now it's down to 12. So it's bumped back like at least 2 years. But puberty itself is all about the hormone changes that are really kicking a lot of these body changes into effect. And something that we'll highlight a lot through this episode is that a big kind of point of this whole developmental period is a transition into adulthood, right? And so these hormones are really, really important for, changing the structure of the body to make it more sexually mature, to make it stronger and more able to be self-reliant. All of these kind of things that are important for a species as an adult.
Yeah, and it's like puberty marks the beginning of adolescence, and so the end of childhood, really, right? And that's the thing. Adolescence is this space, this time between childhood and adulthood, right? And so it's like, it's this transition period, right? And as you mentioned, it does have a cultural element to it, right? Because it changes over time, like how long we're in adolescence for, when we're considered adolescents. But like, if we're going to define adolescence itself, right, it's that the beginning is sort of puberty, the end of childhood, and then the end of it is when the individual is kind of fully independent and self-sufficient, i.e. an adult, right?
And that's fuzzy, right? Like, some people are like, does it ever end then? are we ever truly independent? I saw a study recently of the amount of people my age in their 30s that are still like needing help from their parents because of the state of the economy, like all of these things that are going on, right? So it does have a really fuzzy end to it. But as Andrew kind of hinted at, like, beginning is puberty, and then the end is when you're able to really transition into society as an independent, kind of self-reliant person. And taking that definition into account, it's really interesting to look at the fact that adolescence, in this kind of definition, in our culture has tripled in length over the last 60 to 100 years. It used to be that puberty started at 14 and a half or 14, right? A little bit later for boys. And then adolescence, you were out and independent in the world at like 19, right? You were ready to start a family. You were starting a job, whatever it was. You were like on a career path. But now puberty starts 2 years earlier. And now most people are saying that adolescence is stretching into like the late 20s because of the need for specialized education. We're in these kind of these dependent periods for longer, needing help and support while we become this fully functioning, like educated person that's going out into society. And as Andrew kind of hinted at too, there's differences across culture about when is that time period when you're considered an adult in the Western culture versus this culture versus that. And so it really, adolescence itself is this really interesting transition into adulthood, but the kind of length and shape of it is very dependent on species and culture and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And it can sound like super fuzzy, but I think there are some really interesting, we'll get into these later, but some cross-cultural similarities and even cross species similarities in this period between childhood and adulthood. And again, like, I think throughout this, it's really important to keep in mind, this period is about the organism, whatever it is, especially humans, exploring and learning a ton about the physical and social environment and just how to operate in the world. And we'll get into some of the evidence for that and how the brain development during this time is really kind of optimally suited for that sort of cognition and behavior, that kind of exploration. But there's a lot of myths about the biology and the psychology of adolescence, right? Like,
tons. Yeah. Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so one is just, you know, that adolescents are just these like rage. If you've seen the the show on Netflix called Big Mouth, you know, they have this character that's the hormone monster, and it's like this sort of imaginary creature that it represents the raging hormones of these young adolescents, like as they're entering puberty. And there's like a bit of truth to that, like we were saying, you know, this is huge change in the endocrine system for teenager, young adolescents. But on the other hand, it's like we can take that too far and think that these kids are just driven by hormones. They're just crazy. You know, it's all the testosterone and estrogen and stuff is just going nuts. And this kind of feeds into a larger myth about adolescence that is that it's this period of kind of no self-control, right? But I'll stop there and jump in on that, Taylor.
I mean those are great points to really kind of anchor in on, right? Is that you, first of all, this raging hormone idea, like puberty only lasts 3 or 4 years, right? And adolescence, like we talked about, can last over 10 years. And so trying to explain away like all of this adolescent behavior because of hormones, there may be some changes in behavior because they're feeling different hormones and everything, but what we really want to focus on is putting a lot of these behaviors into an evolutionary context, that it's not the hormones that are doing this, it's the developmental period that is pushing these behaviors because of the shift from dependency into independence. Right. And we'll talk a lot, as Andrew said, about this idea of self-control, because that is not panning out in the science. Like, there's a lot of evidence that adolescents have amazing self-control and they can practice it. But there are a lot of mediating factors that cause their behavior to be pushed in one direction or the other because of what's important to them at that time in their life. Right. There's a really interesting kind of analogy that I wanted to kind of put out there to really highlight this period of time. Right. So I'm a father. I have a 4-year-old at home. And every morning we wake up and I say, "Hey, buddy, what do you want for breakfast?" And I get him his waffle. I put peanut butter on it. What do you want to wear today? Do you want dad to go pick it out for you? I go and I pick out his clothes, right? I help him get dressed. I help him comb his hair. I brush his teeth, right? Like, all of these things that I'm doing for my child, right? And there's this very dependent nature where that person, that child, is able to really explore the world in a very open way without having to really think about all of these things that are important for being self-reliant out in the world, right? And that slowly starts to get less and less as we get older into childhood, right? And as we start entering adolescence is now when you're dependent a lot more on peers than you are on parents. You've started to be able to do a lot of these things. You can get yourself dressed. You can make yourself breakfast. You can do all of these things. And there's these other pushes that we'll talk about for like connecting with others. But there's a reason why we see so much of this like rebellious activity and all of that kind of stuff, because that's what's required to move into this period of independence and away from having to rely on someone to make you your breakfast every day, to get you dressed every day, right? It's a really important kind of facet that we want to really kind of hone in on, that puts a lot of these behaviors into perspective. Because if you are just continuously doing things the way that was normal in your house, like, this is the way that we do it, this is how we're supposed to do it, you're never going to learn how to exist in a very dynamic world, right? The world out there isn't waffles in the morning, right? It's very different. It's hard. And you have to go out there and you have to take risks and you have to try things to be able to learn how that world actually operates outside of your own home.
Right. And so eventually your son is going to not want you to be brushing his hair. You know, he's 13, 14 years old. He's going to get away from me, Dad.
He already does that. But
okay. Yeah. Brushing hair isn't a fun activity.
No.
It runs into this idea of what really is happening in the brain and in the body during adolescence, and why that's important for the kinds of things you're just talking about, why it's important for transitioning into adulthood. But one of the other myths that we'll talk about is this idea that, like, the prefrontal cortex is not functional. So this area of the brain that's so important for controlling our behavior, our thoughts, our emotions, is not functional. And yet the emotional regions of the brain are functional. This is something called the imbalance theory. We'll get more into this, but I just want to flag that, because that was something that I really believed before going into the research for this episode. And it's a lot more nuanced than that. There's a bit of truth to it, but it's there's a lot more to it. But now, Taylor, you have this really great quote that I think we should mention, because I think it like brings together why it shows, like, this idea that we look at adolescents and teenagers as, you know, they're crazy, they don't have any self-control, they're just these raging hormone monsters. They're not hardworking and all this. And this is actually a really old idea, and it's been around for a long time. Do you want to say that quote?
Yeah. So, and I kind of mentioned this in the intro, right? That, like, there was quotes all the way back to Socrates, right? So this was written by Plato. It was in the voice of Socrates. But young people nowadays love luxury. They have bad manners and contempt for authority. They show disrespect for their elders and love chatter in places of exercise. They no longer rise when elders enter the room. They contradict their parents, chatter before company, gobble up dainties at the table, cross their legs, and tyrannize their teachers, right? This was 2,400 years ago. And so it's not the youth of today. It's youth, right? It's a behavior that's really common, and it's universal. Like I said, this is something that when you look at comparative biology and you look, there's this fascinating book called Wildhood, Barbara Horowitz and Catherine Bauer, that did actual studies where they looked at adolescent species across like all of these different kind of domains, mammals mostly, but then also like birds, fish, and all of these things that have very similar behaviors in terms of like breaking away from the parents. There's dispersal, right? The wolves that leave the pack and have to go and like find a new one and go out on their own, right? There's a ton of risk taking. So across the animal kingdom, that's when animals are actually at the biggest risk for predation. And there are specific animals that actually specialize in being predators for subadults. And that's like what they call it in these other literatures. But it's because of the fact that those adolescents are out there kind of testing the world. And because of that, they're really vulnerable, right? But it explains a lot of this behavior of like, I've been with my gazelle mom and my gazelle family, like getting taken care of for so long. But now I need to figure out how to avoid predators and how to be out there in the world. And so what I really wanted to get at in kind of the opening was that these behaviors need to be put into an evolutionary context, and they need to be understood as something that is universal. And if we can really wrap our head around that, right? If we can say like, there's a reason why it's hard to parent an adolescent, right? They're pushing back against me like, right. If we can accept why that behavior is actually happening in the first place and put some support around that so that they can maybe take healthy risks, they can take positive risks, because not all risk taking has to be negative, has to be dangerous, right? But it really kind of understanding the landscape helps us to reconceptualize, not just like hold our breath and hope that we make it through, because if we do that, we're not going to focus on how to encourage positive growth, right? And if we can really understand like, okay, there's reasons for these behaviors, there's ways that we can support it that then give them the best chance of being successful adults.
Yeah. And as you're mentioning other species, there's this super interesting documentary, nature documentary on Netflix right now called Predators. And if you go to episode 6 of that show, it's about wild dogs in Africa. And it's just fascinating to watch it. But what the main character, the main dog that they follow through this pack is going from childhood to adulthood. So you're actually seeing that this adolescent period of this wild dog and how it's learning to hunt. It's going out, it's taking more risks. It's going to the head of the pack and kind of doing these things that are, different than what the puppies are doing, and a little bit more like the adults, but still kind of more exploratory and more independent in some ways. And it's really interesting to see that progression through the show. Also just super cute to see wild dog puppies, and I definitely recommend it.
Just along that line real quick, I've seen these other videos that are really interesting that show these subadult, these adolescent animals across cultures practicing mating rituals. So you have like these birds that'll do these very specific like bobs and like fencing things with their beaks or whatever. And then it shows the adolescents that are like practicing and they're like getting the bob down, but they can't get the like the beak thing down. And then like there's this other video of this adolescent that's just like sitting there like watching the adults do this whole like mating ritual, just like trying to figure it out. And so it's this time where we're trying to learn what it means to be an adult, right? They're observing these courting behaviors and like, what does it mean to court the other, be intimate with others, right? And how does that look? And so when you think about that too, like that's really important from like a parenting perspective, right? Understanding that this is a time when these adolescents are looking to adults for some type of model of what adulthood is supposed to look like, what courtship is supposed to look like, what intimacy, what kind of exploration, what all of these things are supposed to look like. And instead of just trying to tell them not to do all of these things. We need to like actually give them kind of examples and show them like this is how it works.
Yeah. Yeah, that is really true. And I think it's like allowing for that exploratory period, but then also, you know, understanding that there needs, like, they need to also learn, the adolescent also needs to learn to put kind of limits and boundaries around their own behavior during this time too. Okay. Should we transition into some of the neuroscience stuff? What do you think? Get into like the brain and the biology? Yeah.
So one of the things I want to mention real quick before we start. So there's a researcher, Dan Siegel, that's really great research. He does attachment research, but he wrote a whole book called Brainstorm that's specifically for like understanding the adolescent period. That's a fascinating book. It has like skills and strategies for like building good stuff. But he has this acronym called ESSENCE. That's like the essence of adolescence. And I just wanted to just briefly highlight this because it'll come up as we start talking about these kind of different brain processes that are happening. So the ES stands for emotional spark. And so during adolescence, there's heightened emotion. And that's true. There's a lot of like hyperactive kind of what would be called limbic kind of subcortical type stuff that's going on. And the emotional experience during adolescence is really high. The SE is for social engagement. So peer acceptance, peer connection is really important because you're moving away from parents and now you're instead kind of associating with your peer group as you kind of find your new place. N is for novelty. So this is going to be a time when we're trying new things. It's kind of what we've been hinting at, right? You're exploring, you're seeing things. And I think one of the most important ones, the CE, is creative exploration. That this is a time in life when we're incredibly creative. We're putting things together in really interesting, out-of-the-box ways that I think kind of dies off a little bit as we enter into adulthood. And so this kind of essence of adolescence, I just wanted to kind of put that out there because it kind of comes into play as we talk about these different brain processes that are happening. So I think we'll kind of jump in now into like, what is the developmental process in general and how does that lead us into adolescence?
Yeah. And we're going to start at birth, right? Because it's just way too complicated to start at the zygote and go all the way to birth. Maybe we'll do a future episode on that. That would be really fascinating. That's a lot more just biology rather than, psychology. So, but at birth, right, babies are born with about as many neurons as we have now, right? So about 80 to 100 billion, something like that, neurons. There's like slight increase in the number of neurons as they age. But basically, this is kind of like a fascinating thing. The brain has the same number of neurons as it will basically always have. That's like really different than pretty much every other organ, you know? So right. It's interesting, kind of the brain starts its developmental pattern in a very different way.
And I mean, this, you have this like slight increase in neurogenesis stops at about age 5. So at 5, you have all of the neurons that you'll probably ever have in your life. There's slight variations to that. There has been evidence for neurogenesis in like the hippocampus, but that's very small. We're talking like the whole cortex, like all of this stuff has all of the stuff in place. The layers are there in the cortex. The big difference that we're going to see now is now how all of this stuff gets wired up. How all of these neurons now start connecting with one another that then form all of these networks that we've been talking about for what, years now? How long have we been doing this show? that allow for the information to kind of turn into these schemas, these kind of ideas and beliefs that we have as we get older.
Yeah. And so you have to kind of think in terms of neuroplasticity. You have to think in terms of the connections changing. Like we're creating, especially forming a lot of new connections, right? And so it's not that there's more neurons, it's that there's more connections kind of based on the experience of the individual, right? And there's definitely a genetic programming going into this. So like, the areas that sort of mature the fastest, right, are going to be the sensory areas, the areas involved in vision and hearing and those sorts of things. And those, there's definitely like a sort of genetic program to that, right? There's genes that are influencing the way that those connections are forming, but it is also dependent on the experience of the baby, the child, the individual, to sort of tune those connections and create a functioning visual system or sense, whatever the sensory system may be.
Yeah, and there's critical periods with that. So if you deny light to an animal from birth to a certain age, they will never develop sight, even if you take the eye patches off or whatever. So there's a time when those regions need input. They need visual input to start building the map of the world, right? And the cortex is really good at building maps. The auditory cortex builds a map of frequencies, right? It has low frequencies here and high frequencies here that then turn into these associations that can turn into words and into sentences, whatever. And then the visual cortex, same thing. You have this map of lines and edges that then get put together into objects that we know, right? And so we have these early things that are kind of, as we kind of move around the world, they're, okay, we can see things, we can hear things, we can touch things. But then as we start to kind of get older into being able to walk and move, we start to now develop kind of these motor maps of how our body moves and start really kind of learning how we can navigate this world and get the things that we want, right?
Right.
And these, right. I mean, these kind of stay open so there's to adolescents.
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry there. So there's this back and forth between the brain and the sensory systems and sort of figuring out how the world works and how our body works and functions in that world. And then as we get older, the brain, so that like this, what we're talking about now is basically all occurring in childhood, right? In young children, even in infancy. And then this is a period of massive kind of neuroplasticity of more connections being formed, but then that pattern changes over time. That what happens at sort of the end of childhood is we start seeing this pruning process occur, right? So there's fewer connections.
And this is fascinating, right? So one of the things to really kind of put this into perspective is if you look at pictures of like the cortical layers of the neurons and you see it at birth, you just see the neurons, like the cell bodies, right? And then you take another snapshot during like middle childhood and you just see this like forest of connections, like all of these dendrites connecting everything to everything. It's super over parameterized, which means that it's connecting everything that seems to be kind of connected, right? And you see this with children, right? I have a young child at home, and like as he's learning, he learns really quickly and really well. He can say like that thing's connected to that and that thing's connected to that. But a lot of the times there's overgeneralization that happens. So like early on, you learn that like cars have wheels, but then a bike is a car, right? Like, and then over time, you're learning to then kind of refine these kind of associations and these concepts and categories and all of this kind of stuff. And so through childhood, you're basically just like overlearning. You're learning how everything is connected to everything. But that isn't going to serve you well going into adulthood, because you need to, as you move into adulthood, you need the things that are going to be important for survival. If we're putting this into kind of an evolutionary context, right? And I mean, survival in human terms is different than animal terms, right? Survival in animal terms is like, I need to not get eaten. I need to be able to reproduce. I need to have mates. I need to have like a peer group, right? In society, it's similar, but it's more of like, I need to be able to survive society. I need to be able to fit in. I need to have a job. I need to know where I fit. I need to have a group that supports me, all of these kind of things. And what ends up happening is that this pruning that Andrew was just kind of hinting at is kind of like cutting, like just like what it sounds like. It's like cutting the bushes back. You're cutting back all of these things that you've overlearned to really hone in on the things that are the most useful for navigating your daily life, for interacting with people, for engaging in the social world, right? And so you start to then have a lot more refined kind of concepts and some schematics that are useful for language and conversation. You start to see that like as you get older, the concepts themselves become more concrete and able to be communicated a lot easier.
Yeah, and interesting, like on that note, one psychological kind of correlate of between childhood and sort of through adulthood is that there's something called impulsive action. So like the degree to which you act without thinking, like without rationally analyzing your behavior, that is highest in childhood and then goes down through adolescence and through adulthood. And so this is kind of probably has something to do with this pruning, that we're becoming more and more refined as individuals in our decision making, more and more nuanced and better at making adaptive decisions. So pruning is a super interesting process where you would think that like, you might think the more connections you have in the brain, the better, right? But the truth is, like, if everything's connected to everything, then you can't really think, you can't really act well in the world. So pruning is this really necessary process for reducing the connections to what is actually necessary, what really reflects reality, that sort of thing.
And I mean, when you think about it, think about how like, I actually teach classes on development and stuff. And like a lot of the developmental, like cognitive psychology stuff is really interesting. Like Jean Piaget that like studied how children think differently than adolescents, than adults, right? And you see this like very different logic with small children than with middle children and with adolescents as these processes are starting to become more refined. And as you're able to then like link things together in a more kind of sequential, like better way with working memory and all of these things. And something that I think is really important that kind of goes along with this is myelination is happening at the same time. And so we've talked a little bit about this in the past, but myelination is this, it's, you can kind of think about it like the insulation on a wire, like the rubber on the outside of a wire. It allows the signal to be transferred a lot more efficiently. And so you have this pruning down that's happening of like, okay, now I only have the things that are necessary for these concepts and these conversations that I have, but now I'm also able to move those ideas around my brain in a much more fluid and efficient way, that they're not then getting muddied up with other associations as they're trying to travel along, right? And something, before we move on from pruning, something that I wanted to hint at, and this is something that's, I think, really important in the context of adolescence, is that a lot of this pruning is experience dependent, right? So it's about specialization. It's about you kind of having these strategies for going through your life and your brain recognizing like, this is something that I do all the time. This is something that I use all the time. And so I'm going to strengthen that thing and I'm going to get rid of the other stuff that's not useful. But there's a dark side to that. There's kind of a double-edged sword to that, because if you are adapting strategies that are unhealthy, right, that are maybe compulsive, that are maybe like negative self-talk, like all of these kind of things, those are the things that are being prioritized in terms of like being put into place. And the other things are getting pruned, right? And so this is one of the big points that we were trying to make earlier in terms of like understanding what's going on in development during adolescence really helps from a kind of perspective of how we can support these people, that this is the time when we should be learning strategies for emotion regulation, strategies for self-control, strategies for mindfulness, and all of these things that are a lot easier to put in place during adolescence than they are to put in place during adulthood.
Yes. Yeah. An analogy would be like in childhood, especially, you know, between ages, like, I think it's like 4 and 10, right? That's when you can learn language, like multiple languages, the fastest, right? And so that's a critical period for language acquisition. So this is, you could think of the adolescent brain as kind of being a critical period for maybe experience and decision-making acquisition and emotion regulate, like more complex types of cognition and behavior. It's a really important period of time for that.
I heard this fascinating analogy that really puts things in perspective. And I think we should maybe stick with like sensitive period rather than critical, because you can still learn these things in adulthood,
yeah,
right?
Good point.
One of the analogies that I heard was that it's adolescence is like remodeling your house. Adulthood is like redecorating, right? Like during adolescence, you're like knocking walls down. You're adding a new room on the outside, right? Putting in skylights, all of this kind of stuff. But then like there's a time when you're like, okay, we're done remodeling. Let's like let's change the feng shui. Let's, you know, like you can still do these things in adulthood and you can still kind of come up. It's just, it's a lot harder to really like change the landscape as you get older. But I don't want to have this like this hopeless message that like, no. Oh, you know, if you develop these maladaptive strategies during adolescence, then you're just like SOL, you know, because neuroplasticity in a lot of these things exists into adulthood. But something we've talked a lot about on this show is that neuroplasticity is hard, especially in adulthood. It requires you to engage in those things over and over and over again to show your brain that there's a necessity. But showing your brain that there's a necessity is a lot easier during adolescence because that's when the brain is looking for necessity, right? That's when the brain is looking for like, what are those things that are going to make me a successful adult? And so yeah. That's where a lot of the highlights really need to be on these strategies. And it needs to be in schools. Honestly, we need to be teaching emotion regulation and self-control and mindfulness and all of these kind of things that are scientifically really helpful.
Yeah. And one correlate of that, what you were just talking about, like learning from experience, there's evidence that in the adolescent brain, there's higher activation of a region of the brain called the ventral striatum in response to rewarding experiences. So this is a region of the brain that's deeply important for kind of the dopamine system, yep. Right? And so it, but it's very important for learning from rewarding experiences. And as we'll get into, this kind of used to be seen as, oh, well, you've got this hyperactive emotional system, this hyperactive like pleasure and reward system. And then you don't have the prefrontal cortex active at all. So, oh, you're going to have all this crazy, you know, maladaptive behavior. Kids are going to be addicted to drugs and having sex and all this stuff. And but I think a more nuanced interpretation of that is that this enhanced sort of dopamine function in response to reward, in response to good experiences, is reflective of adolescents learning more intensely yeah. from those rewarding experiences than adults do too. And there's yeah. other neural correlates of that kind of thing. But yeah, and so as we get into the neuroscience of the adolescent brain specifically, I just want to say first off that the idea that these limbic regions, these like emotionally relevant regions, are hyperactive and the prefrontal cortex is hypoactive, is underactive, is not very well supported, as far as I understand, by the empirical evidence. And it's actually true that the limbic regions are also still developing during this time. So that the amygdala, yep. the nucleus accumbens, these really important regions for, you know, for processing threat and fear and reward and pleasure, these are still developing also. And the prefrontal cortex is definitely during this time. But it's kind of a myth to say that these regions are, oh, they're fully mature, they're going full blast, and the prefrontal cortex is like asleep at the wheel.
No, and it's not an explanation that holds up when you look at the evolutionary context, because like this doesn't, having a non-functioning prefrontal cortex doesn't explain why a meerkat is engaging in risky behavior during adolescence, right? There's something about that period, and something that I really wanted to hone in on that you just talked about, Andrew, was what's going on with dopamine, right? So there's a lot of evidence that the baseline for dopamine drops during adolescence, and that the phasic stuff, the peaks above baseline, are actually higher. And so this explains a lot with emotional intensity in adolescence, that like that big difference between baseline and peak, that's what a lot of us chase through adulthood, like the desire, the like, you know, pushing us. And you have to think the reason why that's probably happening is because it's pushing adolescent behavior towards novelty, right? It's saying, go out and experience the world, try new things that are different than what you experience, because that's what's important for survival, is going out and learning how the world works. And that learning piece is really important that you mentioned, Andrew, because like dopamine is really heavily involved in the like tagging things for storage for long-term memory. And if you think about it, right, and I've heard talks, Lauren Steinberg is like a big adolescence guru with this kind of stuff. He was saying, you know, I remember things from when I was 15 better than I remember things that happened a week ago, right? If you look back on like most of your really vivid memories, a lot of them come from adolescence, right? And that kind of makes sense in this context, yeah, that it was this period of time where I need to be forming these really important memories that then guide me through the rest of my life, that guide me through adulthood. Something that has always like shocked me and like stood out to me when I teach these developmental classes is when you look at a developmental textbook, at least three fourths of the book is the first 20 years of life. And then the next like tiny little like fourth of the book is the next like 70 years. Like there's so much going on up until this point that is really kind of setting the stage for the rest. And something that's, I think, just really kind of highlights this kind of myth of imbalance is that the purpose of this is not that there's no self-control, right? The purpose is that it's driving our behavior towards trying and learning new things.
Yeah. And a couple of things on that point of forming these memories, there is also evidence that there's this very intense period of plasticity, neuroplasticity between the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus happening during this time. And the hippocampus being this region that's so involved in our memories of experiences and places and like sort of specific things. And the prefrontal cortex being this region involved in executive functions and self-control and even our, you know, our social functions too. So that's just another correlate of that. But getting into the kind of novelty seeking, the sensation seeking type of behavior. All right. So I don't want to get like too wonky here, but there's a really interesting couple of patterns that I want to highlight. So from what I understand let me start with sensation seeking. Sensation seeking is the tendency to seek out novel, new experiences, exciting experiences, right? And that does tend to peak in adolescence. So for girls, I think it's around age 16, and boys, it's around age 19. And so there is a peak in sensation seeking, right? And that sort of goes along with this idea of adolescents and teenagers being these, wild and crazy, doing all this crazy stuff, trying drugs, driving fast, all the stuff we see during that time. But there are two other patterns that are really important to look at. One is something I mentioned earlier. So impulsive action. So impulsive action is this tendency to act without thinking, right? To just, not rationally analyze your behavior at all and just go for whatever you feel like, right? That actually is not peaking during adolescence. That's going down from childhood into adulthood. So then there's a third thing, and sorry if this is getting a little bit wordy, but it's called impulsive choice. So impulsive choice is this, it's basically in economics, it would be a high time preference. It's this idea that you would take smaller rewards now rather than larger rewards in the future. So kind of the inverse of delayed gratification, right? And that does peak during adolescence. So you've got sensation seeking and this impulsive choice peaking during adolescence. And then that might lead you to think, okay, well, adolescents are crazy, right? They're taking all these risks. They're taking short-term rewards over long-term rewards, and that's going to lead them to, higher rates of addiction and STDs and homicide and all the like adverse consequences. But the truth is, from what I understand, is that you really have to look at this on an individual basis, because the fourth thing that really matters is cognitive control, is self-control. And so if the adolescent is low in self-control, they will tend to experience more adverse consequences, higher rates of addiction, those sorts of things. Whereas if they have an average or high level of cognitive control, they're not more likely to get addicted to drugs. They might still be more likely to try drugs or to have sex or to do these sort of risky behaviors, but not necessarily more likely to develop the adverse consequences of those behaviors. So that was my soapbox that I wanted to get out there.
No, and there's studies that show that like adolescents are on par with adults with cognitive control tasks. It's not that they have an inability to control themselves. A lot of it, like we mentioned, is strategy dependent. It's what have your life circumstances been like that have led up to this moment that have kind of led you to be someone who maybe makes these more short-term decisions because your environment has kind of led to that, right? Like one of the biggest predictors of adolescent kind of mental illness is the ACEs, adverse childhood events, right? Being in a very unpredictable, abusive home environment, right? Where like you have to make kind of your decisions on the fly without being an adult and all of these kind of things, right? That you have to think there are very different kind of individual trajectories. And I like how you kind of pointed that out, Andrew, that like you have to look at this on a case by case basis and not kind of paint adolescence as a whole as just having low self-control. There was these really good examples that I heard from, this was actually some of the people that are doing the animal work. They were trying to relate some of the stuff that happens in these other animal species to some of the risk-taking they see in humans. And they have status is a really big thing that's important during kind of the adolescence period, is that because in most animals, there are status hierarchies that are arranged by body size and by age. And so juveniles tend to be really low on the status hierarchy and they're becoming part of the adult troop, right? And so now they're now kind of becoming adults and they're in the status hierarchy now, right? They're not like attached to mom and dad anymore. And because of that, they're very food insecure. Because a lot of these kind of hierarchies make it so that they're the last ones to get food. And if you're the last one to get food, you have to make a lot more risky decisions in order to secure food, right? And they related this back to kind of human activity, that when you look at these kind of low socioeconomic status, you look at places where there's a lot of gang activity and all of these kind of things, a lot of the risky decisions that are happening are out of survival. And they're not a lack of self-control. There's actually a lot of forethought that goes into like, you know what, I am going to make this choice because that is the safest choice for me right now in terms of peer acceptance, in terms of getting through and kind of surviving this environment that I'm in, right? That we have to really put a lot of these self-control ideas into the context that they come from, right? And that's where I really love kind of wrapping a lot of these kind of animal behaviors around some of this stuff. One of the really kind of fascinating ones that stuck out to me was this idea of predator inspection. I was kind of chatting with Andrew before the show about this, but it's this idea that an adolescent has never really experienced predation, right? They've been protected by their parents. And so as they move into adolescence, there's this really kind of wild phenomenon that you can look it up, like look it up on YouTube, predator inspection. It's fascinating. You see these animals that are supposed to be running away from predators that are actually approaching the predator instead. And they usually do this in numbers, right? And so it's related to like mobbing behavior where like you have a bunch of like safety in numbers, right? So there's this really fascinating one in one of the talks I heard from like Barbara Horowitz, where it was a meerkat and the meerkat was with a bunch of other meerkats. And it was a mixed age, like there was adult meerkats in the group or whatever, but it was the juvenile that went forward and started approaching a king cobra snake and was getting close to it and like checking it out, right? And that's really risky. And it actually leads to a lot of predation, a lot of death for some of these juveniles. But they show there's a study on like gazelles and this predator inspection, like the gazelles that approach cheetahs in juvenile, like in their juvenile subadult period, and then survive are the ones that are at the least risk for predation later on, right? And so it's this idea that I am testing the boundaries. I'm learning about that predator. I'm going out and like, I'm putting this in this kind of animal context, but let's step back out and let's look at this in a human context, right? That we're not approaching predators. We're approaching the dangers of society, right? We're approaching those boundaries that our parents told us are like not good for us, right? But we want to learn why they're not good for us, right? We want to approach those things. We want to test those things out and really see for ourselves, like, what is the danger there? And a lot of that, a lot of the, you see, I mean, this is kind of anecdotal, like I don't know much like research support for this, but I've seen it, right? That you have those friends that you had that were incredibly sheltered, that never tried anything, are usually the ones that are at really high risk for then like going down this like rabbit hole once they experience something, right? that it really is about this experience sampling and really kind of testing these boundaries and seeing what I can survive out in the world and like, what are my capabilities? Who am I? Right.
Yeah. And I love that because it connects to some of the human research when it comes to sensation seeking. Yeah. I think it's super important to remember that we're talking about development, and you have to remember that, like, we're talking about kind of the whole lifespan. And so during adolescence, as Taylor's mentioned, these animals that are kind of more risk-taking, approaching these predators, they're ones that are at less risk for predation later in life. And with humans, kind of a, you know, an analogous thing is that the adolescents who have high sensation seeking, that are like really high in sensation seeking, and low in that impulsive action that I mentioned earlier, but high sensation seeking youth or adolescents tend to have a greater ability to delay gratification later in life. So this is why I think it's so important to think about it in a developmental context, because adolescence is about gathering experiences.
Yeah.
It's about learning a ton about the world and pushing the boundaries, pushing the envelope to see, like, you know, as Taylor's mentioning, see for yourself what is dangerous, what the actual risks and benefits of these behaviors are. Because to you as an adolescent, you don't have all these experiences to draw on that adults do. You don't have this wealth of memories to know, like, oh, okay, that kind of thing will lead to a bad outcome. This kind might lead to a good outcome. So, you know, I'm going to avoid that. They're like, they have to gather that. We're not born with, like, you know, an understanding of the risks and benefits of any given behavior. So that's what adolescence is about. It's about exploring the world. And then as you get into adulthood, those experiences can be drawn upon to make more nuanced and more efficient decision-making.
It's kind of funny. I wrote a song in my, I think, like, early 20s on guitar for my dad. And the title of the song was Tell Me What You Told Me Back Then. And the whole song is about, like, I get it now, right? Like, you were telling me all these things and I was like, no, like, I don't want to hear it. I want to experience it for myself. But then, like, as you get older, you start to realize, like, oh yeah, there was a reason why they were telling me that kind of stuff, right? But there's this whole experiential component to wanting to go out and actually experience those risks ourselves. And one of the other things that I really wanted to get into before we get to the end of the episode that's, I think, paramount in adolescence is peer engagement. And one of the things that's really connected to that kind of predator inspection thing I was just talking about and risk-taking is that predator inspection rises as more peers are present. And this also happens, they see this in adolescence as well. So there's this really interesting study with, they have like this driving game where you can like take risks and like blow through like a yellow light or something, but there's a chance that you're going to like get into a car crash. But the goal is to try to finish the race as quickly as possible. Well, when you do this study with children, adolescents, and adults, and they're by themselves, the risk-taking is almost identical across all three of these groups. But if you put the friends of that adolescent in the room with them and you have them watch them play this driving game, the adolescent's risk-taking goes up like sixfold, right? And it's just like so much higher than any of these other groups. And it really paints this picture of how the need for acceptance and belonging has such a strong push on behavior at this time in our lives. And it makes sense, right? As you're pushing away from your kind of dependency, your childbearing upbringing, all of this kind of stuff, you're looking for a new group, right? You're looking for acceptance and belonging in these other things and status and trying to like see where you fit, right? And so your peer perceptions are at an all-time high. I mean, this is when intimacy starts, we're trying to connect, right? And so you really think about like the adolescent saying like, I need those new shoes. And you have the parents that are like, you don't need those new shoes, but like they kind of do, right? There's a perception in their head that that is something that is leading to acceptance in the peer group that they're a part of. And that acceptance is really paramount to them because it's part of their identity. And like there's, so Erickson, cognitive developmental, so he has this whole kind of like, there's different stages of our life that we have to like solve things. Adolescence is all about identity. It's about figuring out who you are, right? And that fits into so much of what we've talked about, right? Exploring the world, trying these new things, seeing like what your strengths are in this world outside of the dependent relationships, right? What can I do? What am I good at? What are all these things, right? The things that we should be supporting, right? Not pushing the adolescents to do the things that we want them to do, but having them really discover for themselves, like, what is it that they're good at? And the reason I bring that up in kind of conjunction with this peer stuff is that if you ask someone the question, who are you? Like, answer that question, who am I, right? This is something I do in my group dynamics class. Most of the answers that you get, or not most of them, but like a lot of the answers that you get are going to be idiosyncratic. They're going to be about you. They're going to be about your goals, who you are, your traits, your preferences, personality, that kind of stuff. But a lot of the answers, probably more than half of the answers, are relational, right? When I answer the question about who I am, I'm a father, I'm a spouse, I'm a scientist, I'm a part of a group of people, right? That part of our identity becomes so salient during adolescence that, like, we want to be a part of a group that explains a piece of who we are. That part, being a part of the punk rock group or the goth group or whatever, like, that's who we are, right? And it's so salient during this time of our lives.
That's such a good point. And I want people to think about if you're an adolescent now, or, you know, we were all adolescents at some point, maybe there's some children listening to this podcast. I don't know. but just think about how, you know, in high school and around that time, there's different groups, right? There's different cliques. There's different, like, levels of risk taking within each of those groups too. And this is something I think is also important. So Taylor mentioned the influence of peers on kind of adolescent risk taking behavior. But there's also something, from what I understand, that the level of risk taking in the group really determines the direction in which the kind of the risk taking is influenced. So, like, if you're in a really, you know, low risk taking type of group, you might not be much more likely to do something risky. Whereas if you're in a group that kids, you know, who are crazy, they're driving down, like, as fast as they can down a mountain road, and they're drinking and doing all this crazy stuff, like, you're going to be more likely to engage in that behavior yourself. And there may be, like, a, you know, a nature nurture thing going on here too, because maybe we choose our peer groups based partly on our level of risk taking and sensation seeking and that sorts of thing. So maybe there's some self-sorting going on there. But, you know, I know for myself that I was kind of a part of different social groups in high school. Like, I wasn't, you know, firmly embedded in one or another. And so I felt like, yeah, I could see the influence on my behavior when I'm with these people versus these people, right? And I think that's super important to mention as well. But clearly, there's definitely this heightened social engagement and need for, like, acceptance and to feel like you are an important part of a social group at that time.
I think there's something really interesting that I want to point out with what you were just talking about. So there's this kind of idea that comes up with, like, why aren't these adolescents able to think about long-term consequences, right? Of, like, what smoking or what drugs or what driving drunk or driving fast or any of these things are going to do long-term, right? And you have to think about how this adolescent is weighing the consequences of the situation. Think about how important belonging is to them at that moment. Losing that peer group because they're losing face, because they're not trying that cigarette, or they're not doing whatever they like need to do to fit in, is more consequential to them in that moment than any of these long-term consequences that you may be trying to get them to think about, right? And something that I think is really important to think about is what you were getting at, Andrew, is that, like, the group that you're a part of has a huge kind of shaping effect on your behavior, the type of risks that you take and all of these kind of things. And something that I really wanted to get out and try to highlight is that risk-taking is not always negative, right? That there are positive types of risks. And there's these really interesting studies that show, because I teach, like, classes on addiction, and there are countries that have really low addiction rates. And a lot of that seems to be because they've developed these really good community programs that get adolescents into types of peer groups and types of activities that fulfill some of these impulsive and risk-taking kind of desires that they have, right? And so, like, as a culture, we need to be thinking about, how do we develop a system that allows the adolescents to take risks, but to take risks in ways that aren't dangerous and don't lead to these negative outcomes? right? Like trying out for a school play or like doing improv in front of someone or trying out for a sports team or do, like all of these things that are kind of on the edge of what you maybe think that you're capable of. Those are positive forms of risk taking, and they actually serve the benefit. They serve the purpose, and they like fulfill a lot of these needs that these adolescents have in terms of stepping out and trying new things and things like that. And so it just, we need to think of like ways of structuring this space to better accommodate some of that stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, I also think it's worth mentioning that like I'll just, you know, reveal about myself a bit. Like I definitely experimented with a lot of stuff in high school, including drugs and other things. And I watched a number of my friends, like it's sad, but I watched a number of people become truly addicted to really harmful drugs. And that lasted into their adulthood, and it negatively affected them. At the same time, I didn't, you know, fall into those addictions. And I'm not like, oh, I'm so great and they're so bad or something, but there's something to these individual differences. And maybe, I don't know, the way I was brought up, or maybe it's just who I am, or just got lucky or something like that. But I tried a lot of these things, and I won't go into specifics, but I didn't have a lot of these adverse outcomes, especially when we're talking about addiction. So like, you know, this may be controversial, but I don't think that experimentation with, you know, objectively risky things like drugs and sex and, you know, even, I'll stop there, but that's necessarily bad. I think it does really come down to individuals. And there was something I was reading doing research for this video, that part of the reason that some adolescents do stuff like smoking cigarettes and maybe engaging in a, like, you know, maladaptive behaviors is oftentimes they don't actually have the knowledge of what the actual objective like risks versus the benefits are of those. And this goes to another point that we mentioned earlier, that like when you give adolescents a high enough incentive to perform on cognitive control, like executive functioning, self-control type tasks, they tend to, this is for older adolescents, they tend to match or even outperform the average adult. So they're able to exercise this cognitive control. It's what are the incentives and, you know, what are the individual differences? I think it's super important. Cause again, I don't want to be like, oh, drugs, there's no risk to them. Cause like I said, I have friends that it very unfortunately went down really bad paths, and, you know, maybe it would have been better for them to not try it. I don't know. Anyway, that's just my anecdotal experience.
Now, I think what really stands out to me, cause like I teach a whole class on addiction, and like something that's really prevalent in the addiction literature is that oftentimes the addiction is not about seeking some type of high or seeking some type of like euphoria or whatever. A lot of the times it's covering up pain. And so a lot of this is kind of experience dependent on like what happened through someone's life that led to this need to kind of numb something inside of themselves and to try to get around something and all of this, right? And this, I think, really speaks to a lot of what we wanted some of the whole picture of the episode to really be about, is to put a lot of this into perspective, that like the experiences that someone goes through childhood and into adolescence are what are then shaping their brain for adulthood, right? That you are getting these kind of components, these strategies, these tools in your toolkit that are being kind of molded and put into shape through this period that then become the tools that you're using for the rest of your life to try to navigate the social world, all of these different things. And so we as a society really need to focus on how we give these adolescents the best chance at success with a lot of these things as we can. And I think that some of it is, you know, really focusing in on not just trying to suppress all risk taking, right? Like these things are so bad. Don't do these. They're so bad. Like what we've learned from other animals is that they're going to try to see why it's so bad, right? and so I think what I really want to kind of wrap kind of my head around as we kind of end the episode, is that this period is the time when we should be exploring who we are. We should be trying new things. We should be moving. We should be pushing away from parents, from society, from all of these things. That's why you see such counterculture during the adolescence period, right? It's just like, why are we doing this the same way we've done it for hundreds of years? Like that's supposed to happen. That's what moves our society forward. That's what moves, you know, there's so much power in adolescence. Because it's the time where we're really questioning, like, why are we doing this way? Why have we been doing it the same way? Like, how do I define myself as someone new, as someone different, as someone that can really kind of make a difference in this world and be a part of something and be with a group of people that I love, that I'm connected to, all of this stuff. It's so heightened during this period of time. And honestly, it's something that we lose that is really unfortunate. And it's not something that has to be lost, I don't think. Right, this whole essence that I talked about earlier, with like the emotional spark and social engagement, novelty and creative exploration, these things that are these all-time highs during adolescence, are things that we kind of miss as we get older, as it kind of gets kind of like pushed out of us as we go into the system and do these monotonous things or whatever. But if you can really kind of hone in on those ideas and understand what the power in them was in shaping who you were and shaping how you interact with the world, you can take some of that back. You can say, I can still be creative. I can still try new things. I still think that being socially engaged is important, and having some connection to my emotional experience is important, right? That like it allows us to really hold on to what is special about this period in development.
I love that. And just as a final note, you know, I think it's also important to recognize one of the most positive things about adulthood, about moving through adulthood, is kind of the difference between adolescents and adults. You know, you could think of it as wisdom, that as you get older, you understand the world in a much more like intuitive way, and how to make these nuanced decisions that like based on less information, you know? And so that's a positive thing to think. I know there's a lot of us are adults watching this show and stuff. So don't be like, oh, we just lose it. And we're yeah, like right. These, you know, boring things as we get older. No, that's what wisdom is. But wisdom is a result of all these experiences we had, and adolescence is this period of intense gathering and learning from those experiences.
I mean, something that would be really cool to maybe touch on in a future episode is the development of morality, which really touches on something that you're getting at, Andrew, is like, there are these really interesting things. There's the stuff from Kohlberg, who did all of his studies with boys. And so he gets a lot of criticism in terms of like not being more generalized, but these stages of moral development are really kind of similar to what you're talking about, that like, we make decisions when we're really young because we're not supposed to, right? That we're going to get in trouble. But then during adolescence, we make a lot of decisions that we do in order to kind of protect our peer group, to protect our family, to fit in. And then what they see with a lot of what happens kind of into adulthood with this wisdom idea that you're talking about is that we start to really understand like how and why the rules in society are in place. And how, like, if everybody is acting like this, then it leads to chaos and all of these kind of things. And it really starts, we start to be able to develop these much more abstract and kind of connected ideas based on what we've been accomplishing and what we've, like, been kicked to the dirt with, right? And so, yeah, I think that development in general is fascinating. And if you think you know what you're going to care about in 10 years from now, you're wrong. And the studies show that, because we change so much through these different stages of our lives. And it's really important that we kind of understand like what the different stages are for.
Yeah. Well, there's a great quote from psychologist Daniel Gilbert. I think it says, he says, your present self is as fleeting as the present moment. Your current self is as fleeting as the present moment. So just, you know, realize we're changed so much through our lives. And yeah,
that's a good thing. It is. Well, thank you everybody again. This These last couple episodes have been really fun. So we did Evolution last week. I got a lot of engagement with that one, which is great. We're going to be doing a Patreon episode next week. We'll release kind of the preview of it for everybody. But if you want access to the full episode, you can check out our Patreon page. But we're going to kind of link these ideas together. We're going to look at like evolution and development as a whole and see how it kind of connects all of these ideas that we've been talking about. But we very much appreciate everybody continuing to tune in and kind of listen to us chatter with each other.
All right. Well, we'll see you guys next time.
Awesome. See ya.